Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
You're welcome back. My next guest is a legend of political satire, the creative force behind the Day Today, Veep, The Thick of It, The Death of Stalin, the personal history of David Copperfield. That was brilliant. He was there for the birth of Alan Partridge, no less, and many, many more. He's got HBO series piling out of him, the movie industry at his feet, but he's doing something very unusual, a stage show, a live adaptation of one of the funniest films ever made, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, starring Steve Coogan, and it's been in the West End and very well received over there since the autumn. And next week it comes to Dublin, straight to Dublin. Armando Iannucci, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that summary of my career. I feel rather kind of under a lot of pressure now to live up to that.
It almost sometimes feels like an obituary at times, isn't it, doing intros for people on the radio? I've come to learn that.
I'm very much alive.
Yeah, very much alive. And doing a theatre show. By the way, yeah. Are you settling nicely into Dublin? Have you just got here? What?
I arrived yesterday, but I've been here many times. Usually on my way to the Cat Laughs, to the Kilkenny Festival.
Oh, good. Yeah. Your familiar face and panels.
Good,
and
memorable times there, yeah.
And you've come to town kind of surprisingly early. The show opens next week in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. Mm-hmm. Is there work to be done moving in production from the West End to Dublin that you have to be?
No, I think the work is the cast just having a well-earned rest. They've been going for like 4 months at the Northcote Theatre in London, who told us last week that we were the most successful play they've had on in the history of that theatre.
Really?
Centuries at that place. Steve particularly, because in the film, Dr. Strange, those who haven't seen the film, and it's an amazing film, it's set in the 1960s, the Cold War, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union as it then was. And a mad general starts a process that could lead to all-out nuclear annihilation. It's very funny. And Peter Sellers plays three roles in the film. Yeah, and famously, Steve is up that. He's playing all of Peter Sellers' roles, but he's also playing a fourth role, one that was offered to Peter Sellers in the film, and he said he couldn't do. So Steve
in an edited film, and
yeah.
It's on stage.
And of course, in the film, Peter Sellers could do one part one week and another part another week, and they just cut it together. So on stage, we have to somehow get Steve in four different places at once, which is part of the challenge and, of course, the fun of it.
So he needs this little bit of time off.
So after 4 months of that, he's having a little rest, and then he'll be back up and buzzing next week.
We're quite chuffed here because normally this would be part of a touring company, maybe with a different cast. It rarely comes directly from West End.
And they were all up. The invite came very early on last year, and we thought, yeah, great. Good to do, and the cast are all looking forward to next week onwards.
And I presume you know how the thirst for political stuff in Ireland is very deep from your visits here.
It is weird that we started working on the adaptation about 2 years ago thinking, well, nuclear weapons, it's not top of the agenda at the moment, but maybe it's a metaphor for, you know, climate emergency and whatever. And then we opened to, you know, Putin, Ukraine. There's even the mad general in the film starts the whole thing off because he's worried that someone is interfering in American water with fluoride in the water.
That's extraordinary.
And now we've got JFK Jr.
RFK Jr.
This day, RFK Jr. this day talking about fluoridation and how it's a threat.
It's going to take all the fluoride out.
Yes. We don't want to be infecting America's teeth by the back door. No.
Someone's rotting teeth. I wonder has he invested somewhere on indentures? You never know. But I presume you've been watching that those Senate hearings or him being questioned.
Off and on. I mean, he's, as I say, the play itself posits a very weird, deranged world in which, you know, accidents might happen if the wrong people are in charge. And then you watch what's on the screen in your telly happening live in front of you, and you are shocked by how little you have to travel to get to the absurdity of the play.
Yeah, literally a health secretary incoming who doesn't believe in science, it seems.
Yeah, or vaccines.
He's saying otherwise, we must point out.
Yes, ought to fact check that, if that's still allowed.
Did you drink up the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis or anything like that? Because that's kind of where Stanley Kubrick was, and that's where his head was when he came up with this.
That's where he was, and we've... I mean, the interesting thing is, and this is the whole play was really at the invitation of the Kubrick family and the Kubrick estate, who've never done an adaptation of a Kubrick movie before. So this is their first ever venture into that. And they were very keen that, you know, we celebrate and honour the film, but also they give us access to all the archives, the Kubrick archives of early drafts. And there was a serious version that he wrote of the film. Very, very dramatic. But the more he explored it, and it was all about mutually assured destruction, or MAD, as it was officially called, MAD, that, you know, if nothing will happen because if we've got weapons, they've got weapons, they know if they fire their weapons, we'll fire ours and everyone will die. So that's not going to happen. MAD. And the more he explored it, the more he realised it had to be done as a comedy because it was just so absurd. So we've taken that a little bit further.
Do you meddle much? Do we? Because there are some famous scenes in the film that people will be looking out for.
You know, and it's very much mindful of the fact that a lot of people won't have seen the film and you're not expected to. You know, it's an entertainment, it's a show on its own. If it makes you go back and watch the film, great. But fundamentally, and it's Steve Coogan at the peak of his powers, four different characters simultaneously, and an amazing cast around him, and there are the odd hints to what's happening now. I mean, we're still set in the 1960s, but there are the odd heightened references to things going on now.
That's what we expect.
Yes.
So he plays the American president.
American president. He plays an English RAF officer who's in an American Air Force base with the Mad General trying to stop him. He plays Dr. Strangelove, who's a German scientist who's now working with NASA, or as he pronounced it, NASA, on various bits of lethal technology. And in the film, there is this other character, Colonel Kong. I mean, all the names,
the names are hilarious.
Colonel Kong, who flies a stealth bomber over Russia and who has got the bomb. And Peter Sellers felt he couldn't do that part. It was a very southern sort of Texan type. But Steve is playing that role as well. So he's going one better than Sellers.
Dr. Strangelove. Famously, he appears very late in the film.
So and we thought, let's get him on early.
Oh, I mean, good.
At one point, the president is speaking to Dr. Strangelove. Right. And we've had to kind of go through many hoops to make that happen. In fact, the president... Dr. Strangelove says over a tannoy, shall I come to where you are? That might be useful. And the president says, well, they'll be useful in one way. And the audience always, there's always a huge laugh at that because they wonder, how is that going to work? But anyway, yes.
The production, of course, reunites you with Steve Coogan, who you've known a very, very long time.
Yes.
You haven't grown bored of him yet anyway, that's for sure.
No, we kind of, it's weird. We meet to do work together and then we, you know, go off and do our stuff. We don't sort of hang out. Mm. Not because we, you know, it's
don't have time, but the looks of your workload.
Well, we're busy. But also, you know, when we're doing things like Partridge, we are spending like days and after days for a whole year in a room with each other. We probably see more of each other than we do of our families at that point. So, and I think part of the joy of it is things like Alan Partridge, which has been going now for, I think, nearly 30 years. Mm-hmm. We only ever take out of his box every 3 or 4 years. So there's room for him to have grown and moved into a new venture every time we go back to Partridge.
Very nice. Steve Coogan, we claim him as our own because he is an Irish citizen. He has a passport now. Any plans? You have Italian connections. Mm-hmm. That would be surely a route into the EU for you if you wanted to.
Oh, yes, I ought to explore that. But I'm very disorganised. It involves a lot of organisation and form filling, which I'm very bad at.
Well, it took Steve years in detailing his passport. The people look, the film, obviously you can be a massive fan, but if you're not so familiar with it, you can go and
if you're a huge fan of the film, you know, your favourite bits will be there, but there will be lots of new stuff as well. Some of it based on some of the earlier drafts that Kubrick wrote that then didn't quite make it, and some of it is our own invention.
So it's
but
like
hopefully in the voice of the film.
It's like an homage then in many ways.
Well, it's sort of, you know, I noticed this when we were adapting David Copperfield, one of my favourite novels, for the screen, and it's like you can't treat it like a precious artifact. You know, you have to do your own thing with it, but you have to always, as you're adapting it, remember what it was about the original that made you so enthusiastic about it in the first place. So if you capture and preserve the spirit of the original but inject it with new stuff that doesn't feel alien to it, that feels part of it. I mean, one of the nicest things was one of the Kubrick family were at the rehearsals, and she said to me, there's a line in it that I couldn't remember if it's in the film. I thought it was in the film. I went back and watched the film. It's not in the film. And I thought, good, we've done our work well here.
Very
because
good.
If you can't tell new and what isn't.
It matches exactly the tone of everything. Speaking of citizenship and everything, you obviously have Italian heritage.
Yes.
Your dad, Italian, never became a British citizen, I gather, is that true?
No, that's true, yes. I mean, I said, and he fought, you know, at a very young age, he was about 16, 17, he wrote for an anti-fascist newspaper against Mussolini, and during the war became a partisan and had to take on a whole new identity and came over to the UK after that. And I said to him, he died when I was quite young, but I remember saying to him, why have you never voted in a British election? He said, the last time I voted, Mussolini got in, you know, so, okay. which, you know, indicates, you know, democracy is not this kind of thing in aspect that always remains as static.
That's right.
You've got to keep nourishing it and keep renewing it. Otherwise, you know.
There's also hope sometimes when something goes wrong that you're going, well, it mightn't last very long.
Exactly. Yes, yes. As long as they haven't changed the rules to make sure, to ensure they can't get out again.
What a way to inspire apathy. You know, the last time I voted, Mussolini got in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Also, when you say things like he wrote for an anti-fascist newspaper, he was a partisan in Italy, then he comes to Scotland. And like many Italians coming to these islands, they end up working in the food industry.
That's right. Yes. They? I mean, he did all sorts of things. You know, he was a joiner for a while and a kitchen, made kitchen fittings. And then he and some friends opened up a pizza factory, and it was a pizza making. So there was a huge, big Heath Robinson-esque machine that went the length of the factory that made the pizzas. And you saw the dough coming in at one end and then the tomato going onto it and the cheese and then the toppings that come off the other end and out to the shops. And that was his last venture, yeah.
Because we've huge heritages in Ireland. When I mentioned to English people, actually, they always look at me confused going, when I say the Italians are running all the fish and chip shops here.
Yeah.
Chippers, we call them. Chippies.
Yeah, chippies. And it's weird because, you know, whenever I hear a kind of stereotypical view of Italy, it's then thwarted by the fact that when people ask me what my dad is, I said, yeah, well, he had a pizza factory. so fair enough.
start with the anti-fascist.
Yeah.
But they'd spread across in Scotland. So Glasgow was home for you. That was your upbringing.
Yeah.
And I believe there was an Irish priest very important in your life at one stage.
Oh, Irish priest. Well, there were several priests. I went to a school that was part Jesuit run, really.
Very
so that who's the Irish priest that you're getting?
You were thinking of going into the priesthood.
Oh, I see. Yes.
You heard a voice through a confession box.
Oh, I know. I know what you're getting at here. No, I remember once going to confession. I was very kind of obliging and dutiful and, you know, did my regular mass and so on. But I was very bad at confessions. And then I thought I better go. And I said, it's been 17 weeks since my last confession. From behind the grill, I just heard, you devil, you. You devil, you know. And it just really shouting at me. And I remember leaving. I was only about 12. I remember coming out thinking, well, that's the last time I'm doing that.
Okay,
who does he think he is to kind of have a go like that at a 12-year-old?
Yeah.
I should have jumped up and down in the church. I'm 12. I'm only 12.
I'm also thinking of how angry a priest in Ireland would have been to be sent to Glasgow. Because they would have been sent.
Oh, yeah. It was that special penance.
That'll calm you down.
I do remember when the papal visit in Glasgow, in Scotland in the early 80s, some minister in Scotland, when the Pope was talking about politics, and some minister in Scotland said, I wish the Pope would stop pontificating. I thought, well, if he's allowed to do one thing, it really is that.
He owns that word.
Own that one. His only job is to pontificate.
Just by being here, you've got lots of messages coming in.
Mm-hmm.
One is actually from one of our great comedians here, Kevin McGarren.
Uh-huh.
He says, my granny's nephew, Joseph Carney, taught art in Glasgow and showed me a drawing he did of Armando when he was a young student.
Yes. Wow.
Do you remember that?
I do indeed. Yes. He was the good art teacher.
Okay.
No, we were split up into two. The year was split into two. And I had the other art teacher who I just found a bit. And it was just alphabetically, and I was just on the wrong side of the alphabet. And Joe Kearney, the other half of the class were having a great time and doing fantastic stuff. And there was just one week, I remember, when our art teacher was off ill and we got Joe. It was great. I'm desperate to know what Joe's up to now.
Okay, well,
there we go. I remember, he picked me out. I had to sit and be drawn by the rest of the class. Yeah.
Can you please ask Armando when a new series of From the Outhouse will come out? It's one of my favourite audio series. I've been trying out the Partridge in Me with my friends. It usually goes down well in pubs, says Adrian.
I know it's been recorded now, so I think it should be out soon. I think it's The Oast House, isn't it? The Oast House. You talk about Partridge. I mean, there's so much Partridge happening now, and there's a new team of writers, well, the last 10 years, really, the Gibbons twins.
That's right, yes.
It's taken on a whole new lease of life. So now bits of Partridge project drop, I believe they now say, without my being aware that they've been made. So I'm a bit like a listener and a viewer now, watching Alan, not knowing what he's going to say next.
But he's kind of ended up where you imagined him at the very beginning, daytime presenting, it would seem.
Yes. It's funny how it comes. Yeah, he's got his dream. And that's the thing. You know, I mentioned that, you know, every 4 or 5 years he comes out and we give him a new lease of life. But whenever I bumped into Steve intervening in between those moments, we would always speculate as to what Alan is up to. So we were always running this kind of 30-year timeline in our heads as to it. So there's whole things have happened to Alan that you don't know about, but only Steve and I have discussed, and we know when it happened. But
he's probably the only Middle Englander who has survived Brexit as well.
Yes. And he tries to tell himself that he's much more kind of liberal-minded, and although the Farage thing, I think, is now making him think I needn't have been. He was putting a lot of effort into sounding liberal and kind
absolutely,
of
yeah.
mindful.
For a time. Speaking of audio series, Strong Message Here is a very enjoyable BBC Sounds thing. I mean,
Thank you. You've
got so much output. It's
so, yeah, so this is a podcast I do with a journalist, Helen, who is once a week, and we look at political language. We just take a phrase that's been in the ether that week and just see where it goes, you know. So we've just recorded, in fact, I think in about 4 minutes on Radio 4, the new one will be going. But if you miss it, we actually do a longer version that goes out on BBC Sounds. So there's a 15-minute on Radio 4 and a 30-minute then goes on. And we were looking at Trump. We were looking at Trump. Trump derangement syndrome, which apparently is a thing. If you attack Trump, his supporters will say, well, you've just got Trump derangement syndrome.
Very
as if somehow that just explains it. Yeah. No further questions, you know.
I was reading last night about flooding the zone.
And that's what he's been doing, signing all these executive orders. The philosophy behind that, the strategy is like, just keep saying and doing stuff. Doesn't matter what it is, no matter how crazy. Just keep pumping it out.
Overwhelm the opposition.
Overwhelm, because they won't know which bit to pick up and shout about. There's just too much, and that's how you flood the zone.
We have loads of phrases in Ireland. Is stroke politics a thing they use in England?
No, I think that would get you arrested. What's stroke politics?
It's a tradition, you know, where you have TDs and ministers, TDs being our MPs and ministers, who kind of pull off a coup for their own very small parish to do something to further their careers. And the opposition goes, stroke politics.
Stroke? Now, where's the origin of stroke then?
What's stroke would be kind of pulling a stroke. Giving
you a little string. So that's pork barrel in America, isn't it? Pork barrel.
Yes,
politics,
yes.
When you get funds for a bridge to be built in your district, even though there's no water or railway lines for it to go over.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We will not be found wanting is one, but I think that pops up every now and again.
Yes. The other one is like, I make no apologies for, and then they say something that actually sounds awful.
Which they should be apologising for.
Yeah.
Or generally your Henry Kissinger episode, which is about, you know, apologies that aren't apologies. Mistakes were made.
Mistakes, that's right. It's the art of giving the passive apology so that it doesn't sound like you. Sounds like you're apologising, but when you look at the language, you're not apologising. You're saying, you know, instead of saying, I'm sorry if I offended you, I'm sorry if you were offended. That was never the intention.
Yes, it's very conditional.
Yes, exactly.
If you happen to be offended.
And almost like it's your fault for being offended by something. You know.
There were kind of specific ones as well. We've entered the word gooboo into the English language, which we have seen in British political commentary the odd time. It's an acronym, grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented, spoken in 1984.
Uh-huh.
Very good year to coin a phrase.
Exactly.
And it was 1982, sorry, I have to correct myself. Where basically there was a manhunt for a double murderer, who eventually, you know, the nationwide manhunt, who shows up in the Attorney General's.
Okay.
A building owned by him.
That's not a good look. Yes, I suppose. I mean, we got from the thick of it, we got a word in the, it was the Oxford English Dictionary's word of the year, which was omnishambles.
Amazing word.
It was at that point I thought I'd better stop the show now because, it was people were quoting it in Parliament and stuff.
It even became a Romney shambles for Mitt Romney.
Romney, yes. Yes, that's right.
Excellent.
There was an acronym that Trump used the other day, which, and I've got to be careful because I know we're live, which is FAFL, which is F, I won't tell you what F stands for, F, around, find out, which means if you annoy me, you'll learn the consequences pretty soon.
Right.
And he posted that after he was trying to get planes with returning illegal immigrants to land in Colombia. Colombia refused. He said he'd impose 50% tariffs.
Yes.
They backed down. And he posted an AI-generated photo of himself as an American gangster from the 30s.
He loves AI pictures with, of himself.
With FAFL underneath.
He wouldn't obviously know what any of that.
Yeah, it's a bit like Kvovi or something, wherever it was.
It's like Snafu, isn't it?
Snafu, there you go. Yeah.
Situation Normal, all effed up. It's like
When I directed stuff, started directing stuff, whenever I changed my mind about something, so I said, let's start over there and then we'll pan the camera. No, can we move that? I'd hear everything with crews saying, DFI that, that's a DFI. On that one, and after several months, I said, "What is this DFI? Is it some technical?" Oh no, it means different F idea.
So that could go forever.
Yes,
Basically that
yes.
podcast.
Yeah,
I mean, for sleaze is the word they use over there. We would brown envelope often comes up.
Brown enveloping. Yes, one that's emerging is miserableism.
Oh right,
it's hard to say. Early in the morning, miserableism, which is that thing of talking down prospects, saying the economy's terrible.
Oh, yes.
We inherited a mess.
Okay, yeah.
Nothing is working. It's all broken.
We've been here with shoulders to the wheel and pull
yeah.
on the green jersey.
Green jersey, high-vis jacket and shovels on the ground was what our Chancellor was announcing yesterday. Shovels on the ground.
It makes it sound like they're doing it.
I know. It sounds very active and energetic, pulling the levers of growth, as if somehow there's a button in her under her desk that says growth,
We had someone promising to be transparent with the Irish people at one stage and was frankly saying, Paddy likes to know what the story is.
Oh, dear. That begs so many questions, yes. I think it was Nick Clegg when he was Deputy Prime Minister in the UK said, I've got a sense of direction and I want to take that sense of direction all around the country.
Yeah, everywhere he goes. Someone says, my most disliked bit of political speak is, let me be very clear.
Let me be very clear here. The contextualisation of the infrastructure project will not be undermined by the overriding prospects of a downplay in economic growth. And I'm very clear about that.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
I understand everything. The next politician that tells us we're an island nation should be instantly dismissed. I learned this fact in national school, but it is a catch-all term. Someone said we can't do anything. Well, we're an island nation.
Yeah. You've got to build. You've got to build out so that you kind of reach the continent, continental Europe. That's what you're going to have to do.
They even use that in Britain, even though it's
connected,
connected to the continent.
Tony Blair, when he was prime minister, at one point said, "We are a young country."
Right.
No, we're really not.
A thousand
we
years
are
of
not
uninterrupted.
That. So I don't know what that was about.
Listen, we're very excited to see your co-adapted version of Doctor Strangelove and poor old Steve Coogan, who you're working to death on the stage.
No, he's well recovered now, and he's in his element. Actually, it's a real treat to behold.
Someone is asking, how could anyone seriously follow Peter Sellers? Well, if there was one person in the world,
exactly,
it's Steve.
What I'd say is you'd have to go and find out.
That's a good point. He's ever the salesman, of course. Armando Iannucci, thank you so much. Enjoy your time in Dublin.
Thank you very much.
Day. Bye.